Yes, we are, Your Honor. Andy Bouchard for the appellant, Bank of America. With the court's permission, I'd like to introduce my co-counsel from Jones Day, Mr. Jay Tamby, who will be making the argument today.
Welcome to the court.
Mr. Brian Murray.
Welcome.
And Ms. Marguerite Doherty.
Welcome to the court.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Morning, Your Honor.
Morning, Mr. Williams.
May I very briefly introduce my colleague at Richards, Leighton & Finger, Rudolph Koch, who will be making the argument on behalf of Appalese this morning.
Welcome. When I start the clock, your time will count down. When the light switches from green to yellow, the yellow will indicate you're in the time you've reserved. You can continue, but if you do, you'll have less time to reply.
I understand, Your Honor. I want to start by thanking the court for the opportunity to appear before this court. I truly appreciate it. Jay Tambay from Jones Day, on behalf of the appellant, Bank of America, the trustee. This is an appeal from the Court of Chancery order, which permitted the cancellation of certain subordinated notes that had been tendered by an affiliate of the issuer, and with respect to which the issuer and co-issuer sought the cancellation from the trustee. The complaint that was filed sought a declaration that the trustee must cancel the notes, or in the alternative, may cancel the notes. What that order requires us to discuss here today is the interpretation of a very complex securitization, a collateralized debt obligation, or a CDO. This is a 174-page indenture. There are 15 schedules, 14 exhibits. And in all of those pages, there is simply no express provision that authorizes the trustee, or for that matter, anyone else, to cancel any notes under these circumstances. This is not a situation where the indenture doesn't address cancellation at all. The contract does address cancellation. Section 2.9 of the contract specifically talks about the circumstances under which notes must be canceled. None of those circumstances are presented here today. More importantly, the circumstances under which the notes can be canceled are specifically enumerated in the indenture. And if those circumstances were present and the notes were canceled under those circumstances, one very important aspect of the indenture would be protected, and that is the seniority of the Class A1 notes. And that's really at the heart of what's going on here. What's going on here is an attempt to cancel notes in a way that would fundamentally affect the cash flows that go to the most senior classes that were issued under this indenture.
So your position is these extensive documents covered cancellation, and unless cancellation was in accordance with the documents, there could not be a cancellation. The Court of Chancery decided this was a matter of common law that was still possible notwithstanding the documents. Is that right?
That's right. And our position initially is if cancellation is not permitted on the face of the indenture, where the indenture is a complex document, where the parties have set out fairly complex rights, and have specifically stressed how cash flows are paid out to the Class A1s versus the others, and what happens when these par coverage tests are not met.
But you agree that the indenture could have addressed a prohibition of a cancellation in these circumstances?
It could have, and I think there's some indication as to what the intent of the parties may have been. The Court of Chancery referred to several model indentures and quoted language from those model indentures, and if I could quote some of that language. In each of the model indentures that the Court of Chancery looked to, there was specific language which does not appear in this indenture. The language that appears in each of those model indentures is the following. The company may at any time deliver to the trustee for cancellation any debentures previously authenticated and delivered hereunder. So each of those model indentures actually has specific language that specifically gives the issuer, the company of the debentures, the right at any time to deliver debentures for cancellation. That language, if you believe, forms the part of the common law, the background against which this indenture was written, that language was left out. If any conclusions can be drawn from the exclusion of that language, the only conclusion is that was deliberately left out. If the model indentures form the background of the framework upon which indentures are modeled and based, well, the elimination of that language is significant. And the elimination of that language leads to the conclusion that was done so deliberately. And then when you consider all of the other provisions in the indenture, I think it begins to make sense why that was excluded. because to permit cancellation under these circumstances affects the calculation of the ratio, and if you affect the calculation of the ratio, you affect cash flows. There's no dispute in this case that the cancellation was sought specifically in anticipation of a breach of a par coverage test. So coming down the pike was an event that the junior notes and the collateral manager believed would trip one of these tests, the par coverage test. And once that happened, there was only one remedy provided for in the indenture, and that sole remedy was you had to begin redeeming principal. All available cash that came into the transaction was used to redeem principal on the Class A ones. By canceling notes, what was sought here was a manipulation, in effect, of that ratio, so that the ratio would not be tripped, not because the deal was any healthier, but because notes have been canceled for zero consideration. And so as a mathematical construct, the ratio was now passed. But
let me interrupt to make sure I understand you. If notes are canceled for no consideration, doesn't that, in effect, add to the value of all the other note holders?
Not necessarily. And here I think it's undisputed between the parties as to what the situation is with cancellation and without cancellation. And there's a chart that's set out, I think, in the Court of Chancery's opinion. And one of the things you see in that chart is if cancellation had not been permitted, if it's not permitted, there would be a pay down in that first month of about $900,000 off principal for the Class A1 notes. If, on the other hand, you cancel the notes that are sought to be canceled, there's a payout of roughly $500,000 to the most junior note holders, the preferred shares. What this affects is the timing of when the A1s get paid back their principal. It affects the sequencing. I think the argument's been made by the plaintiffs that in some sense this is a better mousetrap. This is, in fact, benefiting all of the note holders. The fact of the matter is we can't guess that. This is an indenture that runs through 2046. It's a long period of cash flows. We don't know how those cash flows are going to play out, what's going to happen to the collateral. But what we do know is, at the outset, what was the deal? The deal was that the Class A1s and the Class A2s and the others bought into this indenture on the promise that if the par coverage tests were not met, the relief, the sole relief and the sole remedy would be the pay down of principal, beginning with the Class A1s, then the Class A2s, until the ratios were cured. So what is being sought here is a way of affecting the cash flows that is different than the deal that was signed up for. And in effect, it's changing the rule book in the middle of the game.
Well, and we understand your argument to that effect. And in support of your position, you look at the model provision and you say the model provision could have been inserted and it wasn't. In addition to that, is there anything else you would cite in support of your argument? As I understand it, you have two points. The agreement's complete and the agreement doesn't provide for this. And to the extent the agreement left out the model provision, it was intentional. And therefore, everyone who got involved in this matter intended for events to run their course, and no one anticipated a cancellation without consideration to skew the operation of the formula.
That's certainly our preliminary argument. But the backup would be, what's the alternative? If the alternative is actually to say that, well, maybe a right of cancellation should be implied or read into the indenture, there we would say you can't do that. And the reason you can't do that is to imply such a right, in fact, conflicts with subordination provisions. It conflicts with the redemption provisions of the indenture. The indenture is very specific about how notes can be retired. If, for example, they had sought to redeem these notes for a penny, it would have been impossible. It would have been prohibited by the terms of the indenture. Because you can't redeem junior notes even for a penny, which some might say is a substantial improvement or saving for the structure. Redeem all these notes for a penny. Can't do that. Can't be done. You can't redeem these notes for any consideration unless the most senior notes have been redeemed. So it's not just an issue of saying, well, the indenture doesn't specifically prohibit cancellation, so let's fall back on the common law and see if we can graft on common law principles. The fact is, when you start doing that in a structure as complicated as this, you start tripping over all sorts of other protections that were put in there very deliberately to preserve seniority. The other point I would make, just related to that, is There are provisions in the indenture about how you go about amending it. If you want a better deal or a different deal, circumstances have changed, there's been a huge financial crisis, well, maybe we should take another look at how this deal was struck.
Well, that cuts both ways, doesn't it?
Actually, I'll tell you which way it does cut. If you look at those amendment provisions, what the amendment provisions say is if you're going to do anything that affects payments, you have to secure the consent of all note holders. There are other provisions that can be amended with less than all the note holders. There are even some provisions that can be amended where none of the note holders need to consent. But when it comes to priority of payments, when it comes to sequencing of payments, and most specifically when it comes to anything that affects the definition of outstanding, that's specifically mentioned. Anything that affects the definition of outstanding or Section 11.1, the priority of payments section, or 13.1, the subordination provision, with respect to those three items, you have to get the consent of all note holders who are going to be affected. Again,
as I understood your argument, these couldn't have been redeemed for a penny. And the extension of that argument is, and you also just couldn't walk away completely, which they tried to do in this case. Your argument, as I understand it, is once this complicated document was set in place, everybody was in it together.
I am. I think we're making a finer point, because this brings you to what is the backdrop of the common law, the delivery rule that was invoked by the Court of Chancery. We don't fight the proposition that if you are a creditor, if you are a holder of a note, and you believe for your own economic self-interest, you want to walk away and relinquish your right to receive any property under that note, there's nothing in this indenture that prevents you from doing that. But when you try and take that act of relinquishing your property rights and use it in a way that's going to affect the property rights of others, the senior note holders, that has never been permitted by the delivery rule. We raised this point below. We've invited the Court of Chancery didn't cite a single case where the delivery rule has been used to affect the rights of third parties. And that's the distinction we sought to draw between bilateral situations where the delivery rule for over 100 years in some form or the other has been invoked, where a single creditor can say to a single debtor, you don't need to pay me, you don't need to pay me back. I'm walking away from this. I'm tearing up the note. I'm delivering the note to you. We're square. No further obligations. That might make a lot of sense in a bilateral context. The problem here is the act of cancellation that is sought here. It was, first of all, sought for a very specific purpose. It was sought to affect the par value test. It was sought specifically to affect the rights of others. And that's what we say is impermissible. The common law has never permitted that.
Let me try and get clearer on this. Obviously, this is a very complicated document. Everybody has stressed how many pages of definitions there are and so forth. And we all are stuck, if you will, with the fact that there is nothing specific that says that this could or could not be done. So what comes to my mind is, with all of these fine attorneys working on something that's this complicated, there must have been a reason why nobody thought anything like this would ever happen, because if they had, it would be easy enough to insert some language that would be absolutely clear. So my question is, what makes this set of circumstances so unusual that it would make sense for the contracting parties not to have thought about it and expressly taken a position on it?
I guess we would start with the proposition that it's not a fair assumption to say they didn't think about it. If the parties are believed to have contracted against the backdrop or the background of the common law, then part of that common law was both the delivery rule, but as well as the model indentures, which the Court of Chancery stressed. Those model indentures have specific language that these parties elected not to include. A case that's cited over and over again by the appellees is the Loral space case. In Loral, actually, that was the facts of Loral support us, not them. In Loral, there was a restrictive covenant that was being negotiated and debated. In the final documentation, that was left out.
Okay, well, I'm not really questioning your argument about the absence of indenture language and the significance of that. What I'm trying to get at is a more practical question, I think, which is that if you wind up in court, you make the best arguments you can about what was or wasn't intended and how you can look to this and the absence of that and so on. But we all have to agree it would have been better if there were specific language in this indenture that said you can't cancel under these circumstances, or you can't cancel for zero consideration or whatever. So my question is, since this is such a complicated situation in terms of the rights of the various note holders, what is it about this set of facts that is so unusual that it wasn't really in the forefront of, you know, well, let's make sure that if there comes a time when it looks like there's going to be a failure of the par value test, we don't have junior note holders coming in and trying to cancel their notes for nothing. What's special about this set of facts that makes the situation an unusual one?
I think what's unusual is the level of distress that this CDO and other CDOs like this have faced. I don't think when these were set up in 05, 06, 07, in that vintage, that it was expected that default rates would be as high as they are, and that, in fact, there would be an incentive, which I think in the abstract would be somewhat of a perverse incentive of note holders to turn in notes worth tens of millions of dollars and walk away from those notes, which may be the reason why it was not specifically excluded. But everything else that was built around the structure was built on the supposition that the par value test would operate as written and that seniority would be preserved. My yellow light has come on.
Would you like to save your remaining time?
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Rudy Koch, may it please the Court. Your Honors, this case is much simpler than Bank of America presents on appeal. The Court of Chancery clearly set forth its holding on page 326 and its three straightforward propositions. First, the subject notes were discharged when the beneficial owner surrendered them voluntarily to the issuer with the intention that they be canceled. Second, the issuer properly delivered its discharged obligations to the notes registrar to record them as canceled in the notes register. And third, under the definition of outstanding, these notes were no longer outstanding once they were delivered to the notes registrar. But Bank of America, in both of their briefs, focuses exclusively on the trustee. But the Court clearly said the trustee, qua trustee, has no role in the circumstances of this case. Rather, once the debt was extinguished, which Bank of America expressly does not contest in this appeal, the issuer properly delivered it to the notes registrar, its administrative agent, to record in the issuer's own ownership records, the notes register, that the debt has been canceled. The Court also found that's permitted under the agreement, as I'll explain today, and it is consistent with the reasonable contractual expectations of all note holders. Bank of America, by contrast, wants to, on the one hand, accept that when the beneficial owner took this action, the debt was extinguished, but on the other hand, prevent the issuer from having that recorded in its own ownership obligations and pretend, for purposes of the par value tests, that leverage has not been reduced, even though Bank of America concedes that no payments will ever be made on these notes. Nothing in their briefs or that we've heard here today calls the Court of Chancery's well-reasoned opinion or our alternative argument, for that matter, into question.
As I understand the other side's position, this is not consistent with the reasonable expectations of the parties.
That is their position, Your Honor. But what you have here is you have a situation where they expressly concede, and they say it is not at issue on appeal, and that's at page 32 of their brief, and we bring up a waiver argument, that the subject notes have been extinguished. They conceded this below, and they didn't bring it up on appeal. Once the beneficial owner took this action, which the beneficial owner could take, no payments will ever be made on these notes. Once you accept that, the way the par value tests work is you have to consider that no payments will be made on these notes in the par value test. That is the bargain they struck. They want this court to rewrite the par value test. They want to have the par value test now say that on the one hand, leverage could have been reduced, no payments will be made, but even when you're factoring what payments are owed in the par value test, we're going to pretend otherwise because we don't like the outcome of those tests. And looking very briefly at those tests, they're the assets, the value of the assets, over the liabilities, the principal payment obligations owed through the test being testing class. With respect to the subject notes, no payments are ever going to be made. So you have to put in a zero. That's how the formula works. That's what the parties bargained for. The parties also bargained.
But aren't you skipping over the question of whether under the indenture it was permissible to cancel notes for no consideration?
I did skip that, and I'll get to that right now, Your Honor.
Okay.
Your Honor, they don't concede that the debt has been extinguished. And once the debt has been, and they do deride the delivery rule, but when the court looked to the common law, it looked to it in this way. The court first said, what can the beneficial owner do this, and what is the effect of the beneficial owner doing this? And it's something they don't concede. The agreement didn't expressly address this, so the court looked to the common law. The court refers to the principle that is uncontested, that generally a beneficial owner can do this, as the delivery rule. And the court's analysis in this respect is comprehensive. Now, my friends deride the delivery rule, and they claim there's a multi-party contract distinction here, but here's the key. They don't contest that the beneficial owner could take this action and has taken this action. And in addition, under the common law, the beneficial owner had a right to take this action and to do this. These are very sophisticated parties. Had they wanted to take away that right that the beneficial owner normally would have, they would have written that into the agreement. And that's particularly...
So then I assume you agree with the proposition that what happened here, as it was characterized by your colleague as a perverse incentive, simply wasn't anticipated, but because of the change in the financial world, so to speak, it became operative, and what happened here was totally permissible.
I would agree with that statement. But what was anticipated was that note holders can alienate property how they see fit, and that note holders can submit their notes for cancellation, and that's clear under the common law, and that was clearly anticipated under the agreement, Your Honor.
Well, I understand that, but...
But yes, I don't think...
What I was saying is no one anticipated the adverse change in the financial world that would make it economically desirable to walk away from this much money.
That's precisely right. And the parties bargained for tests that when that happens, you have to plug into the test their inputs. You plug in that has actually happened, and that's how the tests work. But you're right. They didn't anticipate this exact action, possibly, Your Honor.
And what's your response to the argument that the model indentures would have permitted this explicitly, but that particular provision in the model indenture wasn't included here?
Well, Your Honor, I think that goes to whether the issuer can take the action. The model indenture provision is with respect to the issuer. And that is, and the court said, and it sets us forth at pages 335 through 36, the commentaries made clear that when the model indenture was written, that was intended to basically make explicit what you could do under the common law. So the fact that you don't have that language here doesn't actually take away the right you have under the common law. And in the indenture context, that's very important. The indenture is a restrictive document with respect to the issuer. There's a lot of covenants in here that are carefully negotiated that says the issuer cannot do X. It doesn't empower an issuer to take an action it otherwise could take. And the sophisticated parties, very sophisticated in this case, qualified investors under the Securities Act, understand these principles. These principles also lead to wealth maximization and fewer litigations because parties now know, as they did before, going forward, if you don't want the issuer to deliver notes for cancellation, you write that in the agreement. And that's how these agreements are normally viewed. Now, Bank of America on appeal, in its brief, says that we cite only the two Delaware cases that, quote, invented this principle. But the cases we cited to throughout for this principle, Loral, Allied Capital, Realogy, and Amelin, they're all citing to New York cases and interpreting New York case law. And even more fundamentally than that, Your Honor, once the debt has been extinguished, the court found that the issuer could deliver it to the notes registrar to perform the ministerial task of recording that the notes are canceled. And the issuer gets two places expressly in the agreement that expressly permit the issuer to do that. And that's section 2.5A and the definition of outstanding. The court recognized that the issuer and co-issuer are ultimately responsible for recordation of securities, including recording notes as canceled. In this regard, pursuant to section 2.5A of the indenture, it is the issuer and co-issuer who are tasked with keeping the notes register. And that makes perfect sense. The notes are their obligations, and the register is the official ownership records of the issuer. Here, the notes were extinguished permanently. My friends concede that. Once the notes were extinguished, the issuer properly sent them to its own administrative agent, the notes registrar, to record in the issuer's records that the debt has been canceled. And as the court explained, the definition of outstanding logically excludes notes from being outstanding that were delivered to the notes registrar for cancellation precisely because it's the issuer's records that mattered. And under the plain terms of that definition, once delivered for cancellation, the notes were no longer outstanding. That's all the court ordered here. The court ordered that the notes were no longer outstanding. And all that remains at that point is for the notes registrar to perform the ministerial task of writing that the notes are canceled in the register. And
well, do you agree that the cancellation resulted in a manipulation of the ratio as the other side has described it?
No, Your Honor. I think that what they absolutely not. What they bargained for, Your Honor, is exactly what my friend said up here. If a par value test fails, and only if a par value test fails, then they get mandatory redemption, but only until the test is again in compliance through redemption or otherwise. Let's remember that there are lots of things that may affect these par value tests. They didn't bargain to hold them constant. They didn't bargain for a guaranteed cushion. They could have written these tests in a very different way. What they're really saying there is you can't take any action that would affect the outcome of the par value tests. And that's absolutely not true. At B-158 through 160, that's oral argument below, they concede that you could take actions, the issuer could take actions like adding assets to the portfolio that would change the outcome of the par value tests. We cite examples on B-17 in our brief below, which we reference on page 9 of our answering brief, of several other actions that the issuer can take that can affect the numerator and the denominator in both directions. That's how these tests work, Your Honor. And really, in terms of whether or not the notes are outstanding, what my friends would do is they would read the words canceled by the notes registrar entirely out of the definition of outstanding. Their position is that nobody other than the trustee can cancel notes. If nobody other than the trustee can cancel notes, what does canceled by the notes registrar mean? And really, the notes registrar is the administrative agent of the issuer and co-issuer. That's clear in the Bratton Treatise, which is cited by the court. It's clear in Section 2.5A, where the issuer can prescribe regulations with respect to how the notes registrar administers the register. It's clear also that the trustee is only appointed the initial notes registrar, but that they can be removed and replaced by the issuer, and even the issuer can serve as notes registrar. How can it be that if the issuer were serving as notes registrar, it couldn't record that the subject notes are no longer outstanding? That would be absurd. And, Your Honors, if you look at Section 2.9, which is the provision they talk to, it's very carefully worded conditionally. If notes are delivered for reasons X, Y, and Z to anyone other than the trustee, then notes will be delivered to the trustee and must be canceled by the trustee. As the court recognized, the parties easily could have made this mandatory had they wanted to, could have made it the exclusive provision through which notes could be canceled. But they didn't do that. And an example would be a related provision. Section 2.6 says this is the exclusive and shall preclude all other rights. And that is consistent with how the indentures are normally read as restrictive documents. Had they wanted to make it exclusive, they could have easily done so. And there's a good reason they didn't. As the court recognized, unlike here, Section 2.9 deals with situations, and 2.9 is the cancellation provision that they're latching onto, deals with situations where the trustee is involved in the underlying cancellation process. And let me give you two examples. If notes are submitted for payment, the trustee has to make the payments out of an account that's exclusively in the trustee's control. If notes are mutilated or defaced, the trustee has to authenticate and reissue new notes. Here, there's no role for the trustee. No payments will ever be made on these notes once the beneficial owner took this action. They concede that. These notes cannot be reissued. They concede that. All that's left to be done is to record in the issuer's ownership records that the notes are canceled, that the debt is no longer outstanding. Your Honors, we also have a situation where the senior note holders are protected by their own leverage ratio. It's 135%. That is the highest leverage ratio in this agreement. And that leverage ratio is in compliance regardless of the actions taken by the beneficial owner or the issuer in this case. Moreover, Bank of America ignores that if you were to redeem the senior note holders in this case, they would forego interest payments over the life of the notes. We assume that the senior note holders want to be redeemed, even though that's not what they bargained for. Even though they bargained for redemption only if a par value test failed, we just assume that in this case the seniors want to be redeemed. But if interest rates were at a different place than they are today, the seniors might not want to be redeemed. The seniors might want to stay in this investment because it would be a good investment for them. And my friends ignore that completely. And we can't say, oh, the senior note holders want to be redeemed when the economy is not doing well, but if the economy were doing well, maybe they wouldn't, and look entirely to the outcome of the tests like Bank of America is doing. And, you know, maybe these are some of the reasons that not a single senior note holder showed up below in support of Bank of America's position in this case. I think that's very telling. These are very sophisticated investors. Very briefly, my friend mentioned redeeming notes for a penny. He's referring to optional redemption. They pressed this argument for the first time on appeal. It's very different from the situation we have before us here. In an optional redemption, the issuer is forcing note holders to be redeemed. It's saying, I need your notes now, and I'm going to pay them down. In that situation, the issuer has to make payments. The issuer can only make payments through selling assets that are backing the notes. No payments are made here, no assets are being sold here, and the beneficial owner took a voluntary action in this case. It is a very different situation. We also have a very simple alternative holding on which this court can affirm. There's no dispute that the senior notes were delivered to the notes registrar for cancellation. And under the plain terms of the definition of outstanding, as of that time, the subject notes ceased to remain outstanding. And really, this case could be that simple. And Bank of America provides only a terse response. They say two things. Section 2.9 would be rendered superfluous, as would Section 9.6. Again, 2.9, the cancellation provision, 9.6, the mandatory redemption provision. But that's not so. As I've explained, 2.9 would apply in situations unlike here, where the notes must be delivered to the trustee because the trustee has an underlying role in the cancellation process. And Section 9.6 would only apply in circumstances unlike here, when a par value test actually fails, and only until it's again in compliance. And, Your Honors, I think my friends give away the game a bit when they're trying to make this case seem like it has broader implications than it does. The court made clear that its ruling was in the circumstances of this case. But when trying to make the case seem like it had these broader market implications, my friends admit that at least 9 other CDOs have done this in similar circumstances. And to me, what that says is this has become, like we allege in our complaint, a common custom and practice in the industry. And Bank of America would have this court overturn that custom and practice, turn fundamental principles of indenture law on their head. Instead of reviewing an indenture as a restrictive document, they want to review an indenture as an empowering document. Well, it's not. They would read the word canceled by the notes registrar out of the agreement completely. We don't do that in New York. We don't do that in Delaware. We don't do that anywhere. And they would ask this court to rewrite the leverage tests, detaching them from actual leverage. On the one hand, we accept that leverage has been reduced. We accept no payments will ever be made on these notes. On the other hand, even though we have a very clear formula, because we don't like the result, we're not going to let you reflect that in the formula. That doesn't make any sense, Your Honors. I think this court should decline to do that. It should affirm for the reasons set forth below. And with that, I have a little time remaining, but I'm happy to conclude.
Thank you.
Let me start by addressing a point that features in several of the arguments made by the appellees. It's this notion that 2.9 in some ways is rather narrow and is only comes into play when the trustee is being asked to do something. That fundamentally misunderstands the role of the trustee in this type of transaction. And I would draw the Court's attention to the granting clauses that appear at the very outset of the indenture. The way the structure works is these issuers exist for one purpose and one purpose alone. This is not L'Oreal. This is not Tyco. This is not some large corporation that has a business making things, selling things, and issues notes to finance its activities. These co-issuers came into existence for the sole purpose of issuing these notes, taking the money from the issuance of those notes to buy defined collateral, and as soon as they got that collateral, they pledged it all to the trustee. All of the assets, with a very, very small sliver of accepted assets, which is $500 plus some amounts that go into a preferred share account, everything other than that is pledged to the trustee to hold and administer for the benefit of the note holders, subject to the priority of payments set forth in the indenture. So when steps are taken or sought to be taken that affect the priority of payments, that affect payments out of the collateral, the proceeds of the collateral, all of that impacts what it is the trustee is being asked to do, which is administer this indenture as written. And New York case law is very clear. This is a rule book that the indenture trustee is required to follow. These are the rules. We can't add to these rules, we can't supplement these rules, and we can't now empower beneficial holders and issuers and co-issuers with common law rules that would impair that collateral, all of which has been pledged to the trustee to administer. A point was made that the Class A ratio is somehow a higher ratio and that's been protected, and therefore, why is this? The Class A ones have received what they bargained for. Again, if you look at 11.1, the protections to the Class A1 notes don't simply begin when the Class ABC ratio is stripped. Even if the Class E or F or G ratio is stripped, what the indenture provides is, even if it's all the way down there that the par leverage test is not met, you have to start redeeming the A1s. Now, the point is made, well, if the par coverage test had been tripped, so if we were past the point in time that the test had been tripped, then this would be a completely different set of circumstances. And that, I think, is very telling, because in effect, they've said it in their complaint, and they just said it again today, that in anticipation of that happening, they did an end run. They saw that coming down the pike. They saw what the value of the assets were. They knew there was a date certain when that ratio had to be calculated. So a few days before that ratio was to be calculated, they manipulated the ratio. They prevented that from happening. If that's the set of circumstances, if that's what gets them to the result they want, I think that runs headlong in at least two New York cases that we have cited that deal with precisely this type of an end run around explicit provisions, looking for that gap, trying to dance between the raindrops and find a safe place and say, aha, we got there before the test was stripped, therefore you don't get what you bargained for, even though the collateral is no more valuable now. It's too bad the money's going to flow away from the A1s and down the waterfall. And those two cases are the IBJ case, IBJ Schroeder. IBJ Schroeder, in fact, was a case where the trustee lost at the trial court level, and that was reversed on appeal by the Second Circuit. There was a specific provision with clear language that authorized the company to do what it had done in that case. And what the Second Circuit found there was that was an impermissible use of that language. When that language was studied in context, it didn't make any sense to use it the way the company was seeking to use it. To use it in that manner would deny the note holders the rights that they had bargained for. And the other case that again fits on these points is Impresa Cable Vision versus J.P. Morgan, again cited in our papers. And there too, what the defendant. Yes, sorry.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your arguments. The court will take this matter under advisement and will also take a brief recess.
Thank you.